Wonderful, wonderful. Good stuff. We're off to a flying start. So, Bernard, I'm going to hit you with the big question that we like to ask all of our guests. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
I am Bernard Münzel, an Austrian writer, photographer, traveler, world citizen, and I try to solve the problem of people not understanding what leadership, including self-leadership, is about. And I'm trying to bring Eastern wisdom. So what I learned in more than 15 years I spent in Asia to the Western world, because I think it needs some translation, and that is what I try to give people.
So talk me through it. How, I mean, I've got to ask, but how did you end up in Asia for 15 years? What were you doing?
Actually, everything started when I was 13, and I first came across a saying of Buddha. And Buddha once said, "Your mind is everything. You are what you think." And when I was 13, I think that is stupid. I am what I am. So what is the connection between what I'm thinking and what I am? But I started to develop that idea, and I started to like it in a way. And then I started to test it. And when I was 18, 19, I came to Asia for the first time. I by then traveled Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore, as everything else was closed. And I started with Buddhist philosophy. I started with the martial arts of Shaolin Kung Fu. And when traveling, I experienced that people will always see in me what I claim to be. So when I said I'm a poor student, people treated me like a poor student. When I say, yeah, I'm a very rich parents, and I'm like this and like that, and I'm very successful, people started treating me like a successful person. So that was the first time I learned that Buddha's saying that you are what you think is really true, because people will see you where you put yourself. It has nothing to do with who you are. It is only where you put yourself, this is where people will see you. And on the other hand side, being fascinated by martial arts, being fascinated by Buddhism, coming to Thailand in a way, coming to Asia, but then from Thailand was Asia, it was, as I said, it was only Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, it was open, the rest was closed. It felt like coming home. So for the first time, I felt being surrounded by people that thought like me. And I decided to come back. It was a lengthy stay. It was a 1 year stay at the beginning, and then followed many years. I usually spent winter time in Asia. It followed 1 year in the monastery of Shaolin, where I started training martial arts with the Shaolin monks. And so I became more and more attracted going to India and to all the parts of Asia.
And then there's loads to unpack there, so I'm excited for this conversation. And I always feel like every self-help book that I've ever read is a remix of the teachings of Buddha. That's what I always find. So I feel like everything's, I read Mark Manson, I go, wait, the Buddha said that, but in a different way. So I guess what drove you then to come back to the Western world, and what was the synergy between kind of bringing your teachings and what made you feel like actually I can change people's lives by bringing this to the corporate Western world?
Actually, there was a point when I understood that everything is about you. So as long as you are not conscious, as long as you do not know who you are, and that is the idea of, let's say, the idea of Buddhism in a way, and the idea of Zen, and the idea of everything I learned in these years in Asia, as long as you do not know who you are, there is no way to know who other people are. So we tend to always blame other people. We say this isn't working because of this or that ha doesn't happen, or this happens, or the government, or whatever. Okay, there are many things we cannot change, but we always have the choice to react differently on some situations we cannot change. And that all starts within you. And that was what I learned when I came to Asia, because even Asian people always told me, it's up to you. It's not about whether it works or not, it's about how you make things work. And that fascinated me in a way. And then there was something else. I found that Asian people, in a way, they're like me. They will never confront. So Asian people will not fight you. They will do it from the backside. So they stab you from the back, always smiling, always friendly. They will never get aggressive. That doesn't mean they will accept everything. And in a way, I found myself there. It was the same. And I saw so many Western companies failing in Asia because they couldn't deal with Asian people. And for me, it was always some fun. It was always nice to be there, to be surrounded by them. So I say that might be a different approach of leadership in general.
That sounds quite dangerous, though. Like if surely if you're a business owner, surely you'd want to work with people that are going to be kind of disrespectful or deny you to your face rather than behind your back. So I guess how do you combat that? Like if you're saying that in the Eastern world people would probably stab you behind the back or they'd kind of disagree with you from behind, how do you deal with that?
You need to pay very big attention. So let's give you an example. An Asian guy is told, come tomorrow at 7. And the Asian guy will say, oh, it's really, really difficult. I cannot come. It's impossible to be there at 7. So let's say the German manager, he would say, okay, but it's in your contract. It says you have to be there at 7. And I tell you, if you don't fulfill the contract, I fire you. Okay. So the Asian guy would not discuss. The Asian guy would say, yeah, okay, I got it. It's in my contract. I need to be there tomorrow at 7 in the morning. And tomorrow at 7 in the morning, the guy will be in bed. He will be asleep. He will be sleeping or do something else. He will not come. So that's the big difference. Austrians, Germans, Americans, as far as I know, even English people, they would confront, they would fight. Asians don't. They tell you one time and then they say it's a loss of energy. So why should I fight with someone? I told him, if he is not willing to understand the problem, okay, shall he pay for that?
Mm. So it's the loss of energy you spoke about.
Yes. It's the idea is always not making your problems mine. So keep your problems with you and don't make them my problems. I tell you once, if you don't understand it, I keep the problem with you.
Mm. But that feels like it's learnt behavior for that side of the world. But how do, say we're grown up and like we're not at that point in our lives, that's not our learnt behavior, that's not how we act. How do we adapt and how do we bring those teachings, I guess, into modern day lives to focus on the things that actually matter, the people that are listening to this?
So it might be learned behavior, but you can learn it and you should learn it. So all over the world, I learned not to make other people's problems my problems. So that's it. It's always my reaction that causes my loss of energy. Mm. So if I confront, why would I confront? Because of my ego. Because I want you to act like this or like that or whatever. It's my ego that wants me to do that, but I lose my energy. So I tell you friendly, I tell you in your face, it is not possible. I cannot do it. And then I leave you alone with that. That is something we should realize, because otherwise we lose our energy on useless battles, on useless fights, on all that. So we can learn it and we should learn it.
One of my favorite, I guess, parables is the parable of the two arrows. Are you familiar with that one?
No.
So I think it's a Buddhist teaching. Maybe I might butcher this, but it's basically a teaching that says you're going to be getting shot by the first arrow, and the first arrow could be sickness, it could be being betrayed by somebody, it could be a loss of a job, but we choose to shoot ourselves with the second arrow. So the second arrow is kind of the attachment that we put to that pain. So it's like you don't have to choose the second arrow. It's like the first one is unavoidable, but are you going to allow yourself to be struck down by the second arrow as well? So it's like it goes back to what you were talking about there. Like you have a choice. Am I going to allow, okay, I've been diagnosed with this illness. Okay, cool. What can I do about it? I've tried to tell the boss. I'm going through the healthcare system, etc. But worrying and thinking about it and overthinking, is that going to be helpful?
That's exactly how it works. That's a nice comparison. Just let me give you an example. When you go to Asia, it's not because Asian people are bad people, but it's the way it works. When they see you are a foreigner, they will try to betray you. That's the way it works. It's always, you will always pay double or triple or five times more. And there was a point I realized that for me, for my feelings, it is better I do not realize that I was betrayed or that it was a fraud. So I better pay five times more and I'm happy with that, rather than I realize, oh, he tried to betray me, because otherwise I would get angry, and why is this guy trying to betray me? So I came to the conclusion, I say, okay, he might try it. If he succeeds, it's okay. He wins. If he doesn't succeed, I win. But I will not get angry anymore, because otherwise, as what I said, it would be better he would have succeeded in betraying me, because so I would be happy. Oh, it's cheap anyway. But that could not be the solution. So that's exactly what you said with not getting attached to that. I say, okay, yeah, he tried it, but he didn't succeed. And that's it.
Why do you think so many people struggle when it comes to conflict then?
Because they make a conflict something personal. It is the same if somebody lies at you, or let's say media or whoever lies at you. That has nothing to do with you in person. But people do not want anybody to lie at them. So they say, no, they don't do that. Or why should anyone betray me? I mean, what is my worth as a human being? What is my value as a human being if somebody would try to betray me? But it has nothing to do with that. So that is why people try to correct it. They try to not get betrayed. They try to get treated perfectly, because it is something with their ego. But this taxi driver, for example, who tries to charge me double, he doesn't know me. It has nothing to do with me. It's his way of trying to survive, and I need to get detached from that.
You put it so beautifully. I guess when was the last time that you lost your temper, or are we talking years ago?
I usually try not to lose my temper. I really usually really try to realize that the damage is only on my side when I lose my temper. So it happens, but really, really rarely, and not for money or not for stuff like this. It happens when driving and somebody would overtake in a very dangerous way. That's yet, but usually not.
It's the inner chimp coming out at that point. It's the chimp part. Okay, so what other parts of Eastern philosophy, if you were going into an organization, what parts of philosophy do you feel like people should be taking on board, adapting to when it comes to self-development and becoming a better person? What else is there that they should be doing?
So in my opinion, the most important thing we should realize is that everything has to do with consciousness. Consciousness means whatever you know, whatever you are able to do, if you're not conscious of that, it is lost. Just think about an elephant. I usually, in my speeches, I use the picture of a huge elephant kneeling in front of a small little Asian girl. So this Asian girl, she has something, a stick in her hand, but there is no reason for the elephant to kneel in front of any human being, because the elephant is so strong, the elephant could get rid of everything. The only problem is the elephant is not conscious at this moment. The elephant is not conscious of its power, of its strength. So all the power that is available theoretically is useless in practice. So when my organization, my products, whatever, the most important thing is that I am conscious of what I'm doing well, of what I know. Many, many companies don't do that. And on the second hand side, there is one thing I learned over the years in Asia: always focus on what is working. Many people do exactly the same. Just let me give you an example for that. You have a newsletter. So you write this newsletter and you send a newsletter. I did the same mistake. And 2 minutes after sending the newsletter, I said, oh, people unsubscribe from the newsletter. Oh, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 people unsubscribe. So I started thinking, what am I doing wrong? Why are those people unsubscribing? But if you think it further, this is a total idiotic behavior, because whatever I would do for them, these people will never ever again read my newsletter. So there is no reason to work for them. Instead, I should focus on why the others read my newsletter. What do they like? How could I emphasize that? But we always have the tendency to emphasize on what is not working. We always know what we do not have. That is what Buddha defines as greed. So looking on what is working and emphasizing that is probably the best way to success.
It's so hard though. Like, gratitude has become a practice of mine, and it's something that's taken years. What are are there any like techniques that you have or that you'd give to the viewers of like how practical examples of how you can practice gratitude on maybe a daily basis?
You can do it on a daily basis. You can do it personally as well as with your team. On a daily basis, I simply do it 1 minute before I fall asleep. I think what I'm grateful for what happened on that day. So what not not but not I'm not grateful that the food was good or something, but I'm grateful that I succeeded with. So let's say I had a great podcast with Jack, or I was invited in a podcast from somebody from Great Britain for the first time. So people seek my answers, they want to talk to me. So I do that every day, and I really try to focus on what I'm grateful that has to do with me, with my talents, with what I did, with my work. And the same I used to do in my company, and we still do it. Every Friday we have a sure fix. And the first 5 to 7 minutes, we are a very small team, so there is no need for a longer period. Everybody says, I am grateful that the last week we reached this or that goals. We got this client. We got this good review. So we only talk about what we are proud of. And if you do that for a while, you will see the changes very much in your mind. And gratefulness, one of the reasons why people cannot be grateful or struggle with being grateful is because they never learned to think in a good way about themselves. So just to say, yeah, I'm really good in that, and I really did a good job with that. So people usually avoid that. They say, yeah, I did not do such a bad work. But how can you be grateful if you are not allowed to talk in a good way about yourself?
So what's the ripple effect then? Like you spoke about it, about like being what you say you are, but like if you're not and you're focusing on like all the things I'm doing wrong, obviously that might be constructive at points if you need to amend something, but if you focus purely on the negative, like you've worked with so many organizations, what is the impact of that for those organizations, for those leaders individually?
Actually, it's failure. It's simply failure because on one hand side, clients will feel it. Just imagine you would go to a doctor, okay, and you need to have an operation at your heart or brain operation, something quite serious. And now you would ask this doctor, just to know, are you good in what you're doing? And now imagine the doctor would say, oh, I would never ever say that I'm good in what I'm doing. No, far away from that. I mean, nobody died till now, and I really, really try my best, but I would never ever say that I'm good. No. I'm far away from that. Is that what you want to hear? Or would you prefer the doctor say, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm a specialist. I've been doing this for 30 years. So of course I am the best. You're in the best hands you can be. I think that is what you would prefer to hear. But you will always say what you think about yourself. So if you feel that you are not the best, you will communicate that. You will, and your clients will feel it. And it's not about advertising yourself in a way. It's just about being sure of yourself. That's what people want. People want leaders that are sure from them of themselves, sorry. You know, because it's a matter of trust. I need to trust you. The same if you are a leader in leadership, I need to trust that you have the solution. I give my life in a way, I give my life in your hands. Because I work for your company, and if the company goes bankrupt, it will be my problem too, because I might lose my job and whatever.
Because it trickles into like imposter syndrome. What are your thoughts on that?
It could be, but it's not about lying to yourself, but it's about being realistic. So it's we are neither the best, neither are we the worst. We just need to be realistic. We just need to see what are our talents, for example. So we get some talents when we were born. We got some talents we developed or we didn't develop. When we have a company, we have some products and people, we have some products people like. It's not imposing, it's reality. People like some of our products. So I think the most important thing is to be realistic. Neither to be too optimistic, neither to be too pessimistic. just to see how it is.
And then, Bernard, what are your what's your take on resilience? So I work in sales, so one of the biggest things, one of the buzzwords that gets thrown around is how resilient are you? So like, what's your definition of resilience? What do you feel like it is?
For me, resilience means that I can cope even things that don't work the way it should. So I can cope with failure, and without saying, "Oh, I'm not able to do anything," that is what resilience means to me. And especially in a world that is as competitive as our today's world is. You might be frustrated because you see, and it is the same is true for me. I often see that my competitors, my competition, they don't accept the rules of the game. So let's say disruptive stuff like this. So they simply ruin it. So you have no more table, no more place, that the game is ruined in a way. So for me, resilience means that you say, okay, that's the way it is, and you do not complain, and you do not say, okay, no, nothing makes sense anymore if they don't do it. And resilience means for me to say, okay, that's the new rules, but I will adapt to the new rules and I will win with the new rules. I try to be better than my competition.
And do you feel, you mentioned about like talents that we're born with, do you feel that resilience is something that we're born with, like, so we might have a higher threshold when it comes to resilience? Is it something that we just gather through life, or is it a skill that can be taught?
I think it is a skill that can be taught and that can be trained, because it is all in your mind. It is only a decision. It's the same when I ask people whether they are happy or not, and I say happiness in a way is a decision. You decide whether you want to be happy, and it is the same whether you want to be on the winner side or you want to be on the loser side. And many people decide deliberately to be on the loser side because it's much easier. So there you have nothing to lose, because the moment I say nothing I do will work, you will always be right and you have nothing to lose. But in my opinion, it's a decision, a simple decision.
I heard a quote about pessimists and optimists a few weeks ago. I'll share with you and get your take. But it was, pessimists get to be right and optimists get to be rich.
Yeah, it might be. But in my personal opinion, the most important thing is to be realist. So I don't think it's neither a good idea to be what should it be to be optimist? To believe that things will go well that cannot go well? I say for me that has to do with attention, with paying attention what is possible. It has to do with seeing how things go, and then adapt to that.
So let's put that in a goal setting environment then. So like, I guess when it comes to like setting goals, obviously we look at like the Elon Musks and the Steve Jobs of the world, and they have set some big dreams, some crazy, ridiculous dreams, but they met those dreams and they met those goals. And there will be so many people that set those big dreams and goals that don't get there. But, and I don't know enough about those men to say whether they're optimists, pessimists, or realists. But when it comes to setting goals and big dreams, surely, if you've got an optimistic bias, you're probably going to be more likely to win and succeed, or is that wrong?
I would not say that. If we ask ourselves the question, why do those people with these big goals don't reach them? My answer is because they don't believe in them. They just set big goals for them because they heard in a seminar, they read a book about motivation, whatever, and they set big goals, but they do not really believe that they can reach them. And that's the problem. You need to set goals you can believe in. You can believe you can reach. So then you will win. There must not be any doubt.
So how do you build up the mindset to say, like, these are the things I want to do, but at the moment, like, I don't feel like I could ever, let's say hypothetically, I don't feel like I could ever own a $1 billion company. But like I want that. That's a goal. But I don't feel like I believe that I could ever do that because I grew up here and I'm working class and et cetera, et cetera. How do we get that mindset to say, yeah, all right, you believe it now?
You just could do it from the other side. You just put yourself in the situation that you own already a $1 billion company. You put yourself in the situation and then you make an interview with yourself or with somebody else. And this person would ask you, okay, so what were the obstacles? How difficult was it to go there? How difficult was the way? What are your new goals now? You now own this $1 billion company. So actually, there is nothing. Our brain cannot process things like right or wrong. If you think that something is right, or if you think that something is wrong, it is only because you heard it many times or you saw it many times. If I ask you how much is 5 plus 3, you say 8. But why would you say this 8? Because you heard so many times that 5 plus 3 is 8. There is no proof for that. There is no reason that you say that. It could be 9, it could be 17, it could be whatever. But you heard it so many times, so you don't put it in question. And it is the same. The moment you think many times, you imagine yourself being in your dreams in the evening, laying in bed in the morning, you imagine yourself being the CEO of a $1 billion company, it will become your reality. And you will act completely differently. You will act in a complete different way the moment it becomes your reality. You need to believe it. You need to see yourself. Yeah, of course, I can write a best-selling book, for example. I need to believe that. I need to tell it myself, because by telling it myself, there will be some synapses, some connections in my brain, and it will become my reality.
Mm. So what's the, I won't ask for your personal opinion, but I guess what is the Eastern take on manifestation? Is it cause and effect they talk about rather than like the laws of attraction and all things like that? Like what's the Eastern viewpoint on that?
It's meditation. That is how meditation works. The idea of meditation is that you start thinking about something as many times as you need to manifest it. That's how it works. Because Eastern people say you are what you think and you become what you think. So if you imagine yourself being a billionaire or the CEO of a $1 billion company, that is the way you will go. If you imagine yourself, if you always see yourself being homeless, everything you will do will lead you there. All your decisions, everything will, that's how meditation works.
And what would be your advice to, so when I stayed in the monastery, I did 2 hours of meditation. It was like the longest I've ever, I think the longest time before that was about 10 minutes. I had a panic attack during it. I had this beautiful visualization. For somebody that's never meditated before or they're thinking about doing it, what would you suggest? How would you suggest they start?
I would suggest to start with understanding what meditation is as an idea. And meditation as an idea means to not attach to your thoughts, be they good or be they bad. So I always give an example as a visualization that you sit in a park. Okay, there is a beautiful park, there's nice weather, you sit in the park and you sit on a bank. Okay, and now you see people, watch people passing you. Okay, and they talk. And there is the first couple and they say, and I'm so angry because this and that and that and that happens. And then this couple goes further down the way. And then there is another couple and she will say, you know, I'm so sad about this. And it really breaks my heart that this and this and this happens. And then you hear the voices fading and they go further their way down. And this happens with many different feelings, okay? But you would never ever have the idea to run after them and say, sorry, excuse me, I know it's not my problem, but what were you talking about? What is your problem? No, you just see them come. You see, okay, they have a problem, they are happy, they are whatever, and then you let them go. And the same thing you need to learn to do with your thoughts. So not attach them, not try to keep them, you know? So everything will go worse. It will go, everything will go down the river, whatever. And then you start entering in that. You say, okay, at the moment I feel this and I let it go. That is how meditation starts. And the technique is, even if you do it 3 minutes, you just observe your thoughts, You observe them coming, you let them go. And the most important thing is people do not, and many people don't know that. It has to do with your breathing. So the moment you breathe in, you breathe in your thoughts. You manifest your thoughts. The moment you breathe out, you let them go. So you should be during a meditation. That is the only thing, the only advice I would give, to be very careful. I let go. When I think about letting go, I let also my breath go. And the same when I want to manifest, I try to get some air in my lungs. Mm-hmm. And if you do that 3, 4, 5 minutes, it's enough. And then you can extend it. You can do it for 10 minutes. I do not meditate for 2 hours because for me, it's enough to do it 10 minutes.
Mm. What's your relationship like with meditation? What does that look like?
It looks like that in the morning, when my brain is fresh after waking up, I usually sit 10, 15, 20 minutes in front of Buddha. I have a Buddha statue and I talk to him. So I tell him what my thoughts are, what my plans are for the day, what I'm grateful for, what I might be afraid of, and I try to get some answers. So somebody said when you pray, you talk to a source, but when you meditate, the source talks to you. And it's pretty much about freeing your mind, freeing your mind and being receptive for new answers, for new ideas.
And then the companies that you work with, when you're brought in by them, what are they typically trying to solve? What problems are they trying to fix? What have you been brought in to help them with?
Usually it has to do with leadership problems. So I had quite a lot of companies, and this is the most interesting work, but also the most difficult kind of work. I would usually talk to the employees, and then I would go to the boss, and I would try to tell the boss what the problems are without telling him who told me that. So that's usually the main problem. Leadership problems, demotivated employees who do not identify with the company, stuff like this.
And what's usually the, obviously you don't need to give me specifics, but what's usually the root cause? Is it micromanagement? What does it look like?
Usually the problem is that the employees don't see any sense in what they are doing. That's the main problem they have. So for example, now I work for a pharmacy, and all the employees, they told me, okay, I come here in the morning. It's a huge chain with many, many pharmacies. And they told me, okay, I come here in the morning and I leave in the evening and nothing changes. So every day, the same recipes, the same old people that would ask me, why do I get this medicine and not that medicine? And why didn't the doctor prescribe this medicine? It's always the same. So in a way, they feel a lack of sense in what they do. So they do not feel that they would develop. So they say, I come in the morning, and when I close the pharmacy in the evening, everything is the same. So, but in my opinion, that's a pity, because every employee has huge potential, because those are the people who work with your clients. So I told them, just to give you an idea, I told them, okay, get use that potential, make them pay much more attention to their clients' behavior, make them pay attention on what the clients do. So they enter the shop, where will they go? What will they see? What medicine, where would they look? Stuff like this. So the employees feel useful.
How, I guess, If you're working with people and individuals that kind of lack that purpose, where do you start? What are the questions that you'd want to ask somebody that's struggling at the moment that feels like a lack of purpose? What questions would you want them to ask them that they could possibly ask themselves to help them establish that sense of purpose?
When you decided to do this or that job, you did this with some expectations. You had an idea of what the job would be like. Do you still know that? Do you still know why you started here in this company? What was your idea? Where did you see you after 1 year, after 5 years? There was a reason. So I always say to leaders, I always say, everybody that would work with you has a reason for doing so. So there is something they like. There was something they are fascinated by. That there is a reason why you would work for a boss and you would not work for another boss. But the boss should know that. We always should know. It is the same. It's the same. I always tell my clients, get to know why your clients buy your products. And the same I tell the employees, you had a reason why you started here. You had a purpose. So do you still know it? Did you lose it? Why did you lose it? So is it really your boss that doesn't do what you want, or is it yourself? Is it daily routine and you didn't develop anymore? You didn't become better. You just remained where you are.
And typically, is it down to the individual or is it down to leadership? Why there's been that breakdown in purpose?
Actually, because people don't feel seen anymore. That's the main problem. The larger a company grows, the less people feel seen. And that's the main problem. They say, what if I die tomorrow? Nothing changes. I know that. But I want it to be different.
Mm. So I'm a manager. I've got a team of around 15. We're due to grow soon, so we're going to be about 20. How do I make the team feel seen? What can I implement to make them feel like they belong even more? What more can I be doing, Bernard?
Actually, it's about consciousness again. And I always say that a good leader, he or she should not waste resources. So a good leader should really know all the resources there are in the company. And the moment you know the resources and you say, hey, Jack, you are very good in talking, so I would need you. And I would tell you this, you feel seen. If I say, Jack, tomorrow you do the podcast, it's something else. But if I say, yeah, I really like the way you do it, you will feel seen. And there is one thing we should not forget, that power has nothing to do with violence. Power always works with that feeling of being accepted. And that's what we can use.
So this might be a really stupid question, but obviously every day is a school day, but I'm going to ask it. How often should leaders be doing that then? How often should leaders be making their team feel seen? Because is there a detriment to, if every time I walk past someone, I say something that makes them feel seen? Is there a detriment to that?
No, I would not do that. No. I mean, we are dealing with adult people. It's not that in the kindergarten that I always need to say how good everybody is. And people would feel that it's only a maneuver. So it's only kind of marketing, let's say, like this.
Yeah.
No, but it starts the moment I attach a job to you. I ask you to do something specifically, something bigger. The moment I ask you to lead a project, the moment I tell you why I want you to do that, you feel seen. It's that easy. It has nothing to do with meeting at the ale and saying, oh, Jack, you are the greatest or the best. That might be the American style. No. But the moment I say, Jack, I like the way you express yourself in English, for example, you will feel that it was not a coincidence that I chose you. You will say, okay, yeah, probably Bernard thought why he chose me and why he gave this responsibility to me.
And then so what does this look like in the Eastern world? Like, would you say hands down they're better leaders, they're better managers than the West?
Yes, I would say, but it's a total different companies, but it has to do with confronting, and it has to do with, I think that Asian people in general, they are very good at imitating. So it's one of the basic Asian ideas, one of the basic ideas of Zen Buddhism, to unite with your opponent, to become your opponent. So it's not important what you think. It's important what your employees, what your clients, whoever thinks. It's not important why you would buy a product or why you would buy your product. It's important why your clients buy your product. And that is what Asian people understand. So let's say I make a product and this product is extremely environment friendly. Okay, so I want my clients to buy this product because it is so environmental friendly. But maybe the reason why my clients buy the product is because they like the color, because they like my haircut, because whatever. So it always has to do with ego. And Asian people, usually they step back from that ego. They say, okay, if you buy it because of the color, I give you more of that. It makes no difference. I do not force you to buy it for my reasons. And if you want to work in my company because you like my voice, because you like the way I handle you, whatever, if that is the reason, you are free to do that. But Western people, usually they have some we have so many expectations. So whatever we do, we do with some expectations. You know, when you go in a shop and you say good morning, you do it with the expectation that the person working there would say, hi, good morning, the same. So you'll be very disappointed if this person would ignore you. Asian people say, no, don't do it. Do it for the thing. Do it for saying good morning, but not with any expectations. And in my opinion, that makes them much better leaders because they step back from their ego.
Mm. I always think the happiness equation is where expectations meet reality. So you're right. If you can remove those expectations, you'll live a much happier life. What can people be doing to step back from their ego? It's something that gets in the way all the time. People feel personally attacked. People don't feel validated enough. Especially in sales, where rejection happens on an hourly basis, what can people do to remove themselves from ego? What kind of hard conversations do they need to have with themselves?
What I said before, focusing on what works. Actually, the only thing I need when I deliver a speech, let's say I deliver a keynote, I am on a stage. So after that, I need to know that I delivered the best speech possible. I cannot force you to like it. I can force nobody to like it. But I can know that I did the best. And it is the same in sales. I can know that I try to sell the best product, the best possible product in the best possible way. But I cannot force you to like it. I cannot force you to need it. And if you do not need it, you do not need it. So that is also something Asian people usually don't try to force you. They would step back immediately because so they know if I would have another problem, I would think about this salesman, about this person that was so nice and so helpful. And I would call him and I would say, hey, I have another problem and I didn't buy last time, but now I'm back. But for me, it's always about knowing for myself that I delivered the best product possible. The rest is not under my control, so it's not my problem either. And it cannot be my problem.
Mm. And one of the biggest things that salespeople struggle with is the attachment to the outcome. And I believe is that a Buddhist teaching? Suffering is the root of all evil, attachment.
Yes, that is the main idea of Buddha. So the main idea of Buddha, it's greed. And Buddha, when Buddha talks about greed, he doesn't talk about money or about possession. For Buddha, greed means that we want things to be differently than they are. So a situation is like it is, and we hate it. And instead of changing it, we suffer. And we see, oh, of course, it happens to me and only to me, and I'm the only person with that problem. Okay, that doesn't change the situation. That doesn't change the situation. So to detach yourself means to say, okay, for the moment, the situation is the way it is. I can change it in 5 seconds. But I will not complain that it happened to me and I'm always the poor guy and I'm always the loser, whatever. No, it's the way it is. No idea why, makes no difference. I can change it. Mm. I have a new client, I have a new tribe. That's how Buddhists would handle that.
Because people say, why me? And the retort to that is, why not me? Like, why not?
Actually, there is a Buddhist saying, if you understand it, things are the way they are. If you do not understand it, things are the way they are. And that's pretty true.
I love that. I sometimes confuse Buddhism and Stoicism and various other bits, but I think it's all an amalgamation. But there's whether you say you can or you can't, you're right, which is a similar
thing. Yeah, that was Henry Ford, yeah. That was okay. Henry Ford, yeah.
So
In a way, Buddhism and Stoicism, they are quite similar. The ideas are quite similar. They're not that far. Only the goal is different. So
Break that down for me, Bernard, then. The goal is to.
actually, the idea of Buddhism is that Buddha, just to explain the goal of Buddhism. Buddha, he was Hinduist, so his religion was Hinduism, and Hinduists, they believe in rebirth. So you will get reborn and reborn and reborn and reborn. And Buddha tried to find a way to get rid of that, so that it's not necessary anymore to get reborn, because Buddha said to live means suffering. And Buddha said, okay, you get reborn because your soul is greedy to live another life. So that's why you need to come back. The moment you are satisfied with whatever you have, there is no more reason to come back to this world. And then you will be free. That is the main idea.
And that
In a
is that's
way,
Nirvana.
sorry.
Nirvana blowing out,
Yeah,
is that what it's
exactly.
called?
That means Nirvana. Nirvana means that you are free. There is no reason, no more greed. You are happy with the way things are. And then there will be no more reason to come back to this earth.
Oh, Bernard, I've absolutely loved this conversation. I could talk to you all day. Obviously, I have a real fondness for Buddhism. I guess let me ask you one last question before I let you go. What, apart from your own books, obviously, but what non-fiction books would you recommend to the listeners if they want to develop into better people, have more resilience, and become better leaders? What kind of what things from your library would you recommend?
So I would recommend Sun Tzu, The Art of War, which is one of the best books that was ever written. I mean, this book is 2,500 years old, and it is still, for me, it is one of the best books on leadership, on self-development, on whatever. The second book I quoted many, many times is Miyamoto Musashi, The Book of the Five Rings. Musashi, he was a fighter, he was a sword fighter, he was a samurai, and he had incredible insights. A very, very thin book, but I think I read it for at least 10 times, if not more often. And he doesn't, but what I like on these books, the same Sun Tzu and Musashi, he doesn't tell you how to do it. He just shows you some options, and you can think about it, and you will. He says, okay, if a soldier, for example, to give an example that really, really fascinated me, Sun Tzu says, when the soldiers come to a river, observe them and observe what they do. Should the soldiers drink first before the horses, that means the enemy has no water. And just the idea of observing what other people do and make some conclusions of that, and it's so logical. So, of course, if they drink first and don't let their horses drink first, that means they ran out of water, so they have another problem, and stuff like this. So they will he doesn't tell you what to do. He just says, okay, if it is like this, the situation is like this, and he leaves it to you to develop your own ideas on that.
Beautiful.
So yeah,
And I was
so
going to say, what's one quote that you live and die by? What's your favorite quote?
My favorite quote is the one I started this podcast with, when Buddha said, "Your mind is everything. You are what you think." For me, this is the most powerful quote, and because it means I can change in every single second. I can change what I am, and I can change what I become. It's only up to me.
An incredible conversation. Bernard, thank you so much for joining us. I guess if people want to work with you, they want to check out your books, or they want to check you out, where can they find you?
Easiest on my website, www.moestl.com, and then you just click on the English version and you will find everything in English.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jack.